The Tom Woods Show, episode 699.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're a homeschooling parent and you're tired of running yourself ragged, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And check it out through my special link where you get three free bonuses totaling $160. My special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Seems like lately I'm always talking about stupidity on the universities, but it's just such a rich subject with so many areas to explore. And one of the things going on some universities these days is a fossil fuel divestment movement among the students, trying to get the university to move its investments out of fossil fuels and into whatever else. And there are a lot of reasons that that's not a wise thing to do. And it's interesting to talk about because there's so many topics are related to this. University stupidity, fossil fuels, etc. So joining me to talk about this phenomenon is the co-author of a new academic paper on this subject and why it's a bad idea. And that's Pierre Desrochers, who joins us once again. He is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto. He's an affiliated scholar with the Mercatus Center, and he holds his PhD from the University of Montreal. Pierre, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I've been reading your paper, just told people about it, and I thought it'd be an interesting topic for discussion, especially with all the attention that Alex Epstein has been getting on the fossil fuels front. And, you know, now he's attracted quite a bit of notoriety for himself on precisely this topic.
No, he's been indeed very effective.
Yeah, that's right. And he's extremely unapologetic. He's in that way a very classic Randian, I suppose. I'm going to link to this paper that you sent. I assume that's okay.
Sure.
This will be linked at tomwoods.com/699 so people can read for themselves. But the executive summary gives people a good sense of where you're going with this, but as does the table of contents. So if people just want to take a quick look at it, they'll get a sense of all the stuff that you're covering here. But let's first talk about, when did this whole fossil fuel divestment movement get started?
Well, it got started in 2010 when some student activists at Swarthmore in Pennsylvania, a very posh college, as some of your listeners may know, got interested in mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia. Then at first it was about coal. But fast forward in 2012, and this is where Bill McKibben, a prominent environmental catastrophist and activist, sort of gave a new leap to the movement by reframing it as a fight against global carbon emission. And so McKibben and his organization, 350.org, claimed that they were inspired by the anti-apartheid and anti-tobacco movement and past divestment movement, and decided to take the fight to college campuses in an attempt to avoid politics, because they realized that politicians were not really listening. So they figured that they would hit companies where it would hurt them, which is their wallet, or in that case, their stock value. And they began, a coalition was formed, which became very influential on the English-speaking world university campuses, to pressure presidents and university board to divest their stock holding in carbon-filled companies.
Why is it that they want to do this? What is the ideology behind it?
Well, the ideology is that the burning of carbon fuels emit greenhouse gas emission, and there is a widespread consensus that we're all going to fry sooner or later. So basically, we're forsaking students' future by our dependence on carbon fuel, and humanity should break its addiction to that. The problem is that most of the kids don't realize that carbon fuels also have benefits. So the benefits of carbon fuels and synthetic products, so products that are mostly derived from petroleum, but to a lesser extent from natural gas and coal, these products, these benefits are taken for granted. And somehow the assumption is that going on in terms of business as usual will wreck the planet's future. And so we must really cut our addiction to fossil fuels.
All right, but I can understand why people would maybe sympathize with that point of view. They've heard nothing but climate change, climate change, climate change. And they've heard that there's at least the possibility that this could work out catastrophically for us. So aren't they just engaged in a reasonable effort to hold off catastrophe? Isn't there something reasonable about that at heart?
Well, it would seem, but if they were to look at their own rhetoric more closely, they would see a major problem. Again, I was telling you that the movement has been spearheaded by an organization that is called 350.org. And what they mean by that is that anything beyond 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, so 0.0035%, should be dangerous and would bring us to a threshold from which we could never recover. So this is based mostly on the work of James Anson, a prominent climate scientist, was also a prominent catastrophist. The problem is that this quote-unquote threshold was passed a generation ago in the early 1990s, and now we're probably above 400 parts per billion. And the only thing that has happened in the meantime is that global warming became climate change. So that would be the one thing. You know, we're still looking for these risks. And the other thing is, but more seriously, and where I think the paper makes a contribution that is somewhat distinct in the literature, is that activists only look at hypothetical risks and completely ignore the real tangible benefits that were delivered by carbon fuels and synthetic product. So if you go back, let's say, two centuries ago, before coal became important and later on petroleum and natural gas, you had about 1 billion people on Earth who were living on average maybe 30 years and who were miserable. Today, there's over 7 billion of us. We have a standard of living that our ancestors could not have imagined. And granted, you know, entrepreneurship, innovation, good institutions are all important in that, but there's no way that we would have what we have today without carbon fuels. And so the first irony that is completely missed by activists who tell us that billions of lives are at stake is that there wouldn't be billions of lives to begin with if humanity had not used a lot of carbon in the past.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I've had somebody who basically is an anti-civilization anarchist. I mean, that's really how she describes herself. She's anti-civilization. Civilization is unsustainable, she says, and it has led. She said that I basically refuse to recognize the merits of her arguments because I need to stay in my comfortable delusions so I can continue to enjoy the benefits of civilization. But she says that civilization is itself the problem. It was very, very blunt and frank about this. And I, for a long time, I thought people like that didn't actually exist, but they in fact do. And so she even said—
And some of them are even tenured.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And so she even said that the civilization that I defend has led to the loss of countless lives. And my response was, well, if we got rid of the civilization I defend, you don't even deny that we would, that certainly billions of people would perish. So don't come telling me all about human life, which is the one thing you care nothing about.
Yeah, that's the thing. And the irony, and what is difficult for these people to grasp, is that, again, there were human population has gone up by about 7 times, let's say, in the last 2 centuries. And yet you look at every environmental indicator, and most of them are actually doing a lot better. So our air is cleaner, our water is less polluted, forests are making a comeback the world over. And what happened really is that humanity substituted resources that were produced on the surface. So, you know, plants, animals, things that we used to grow for synthetic dyes, wood, biomass, what have you, by resources that came from under the ground, so coal, natural gas, petroleum. And this is how humanity and civilization were able to achieve the remarkable feat of, on the one end, having our economic and slash growth cake, and on the other, improving the state of our environmental cake too. But you needed a huge serving of fossil fuels to make that possible. And so what these people are missing is that, again, the substitution of resources that came from the surface by resources that came from underground. And if you're somehow able to get that into their head, perhaps you'll get them to think of it. I've got one case in mind where I think I made some progress, but again, the role of carbon fuel is completely misunderstood or underappreciated by these people.
What's the impact on the world's poor if the policies these people favor were to be implemented?
Well, they'll remain poor. They won't be able to escape poverty. So far, there hasn't been any society that has progressed throughout history without plentiful, reliable, and abundant fossil fuels. And, you know, these people will be subjected to the vicissitude of the weather, too. And again, I grew up in Canada where it's pretty cold and, you know, most people wouldn't want to live there, especially Quebec, where I'm from. But the fact is that even people who live in tropical locations, and human beings are essentially tropical creatures, struggle with nature all the time and are miserable, whereas rich people can live well in cities from Edmonton to Singapore. So again, what really gets to me with the fossil fuel divestment activists is that they don't even propose to boycott the product that they're against. So, you know, in the past, anti-apartheid activists would not eat oranges from South Africa. Anti-tobacco activists, as far as I know, were not smokers, or at least they would not advertise it. But you go to a fossil fuel divestment activist manifestation on any campus, and you see banners made out of petroleum products. You see them looking at their smartphone. They're coming in on bicycles with synthetic rubber tires. And, you know, if you're serious in your notion that on the one end, carbon fuels or synthetic products are killing the planet, and on the other, that there are real-world alternatives, well, why bother with divestment? Why don't just go with a simple old-fashioned boycott?
Well, indeed. And I think I have an answer to that question.
Which would be?
Which would be that in this particular type of case, I mean, nobody minds boycotting lettuce or whatever. You know, you can, there are near substitutes, but you'd have to boycott all your comforts, right? I mean, nobody wants to do that. They'd rather hold us, especially college students.
Especially
the most spoiled people in the world. Now, I'm going to get some complaints about that, but they are.
No, but you see, I actually give them a few ideas in the paper. So limit your internet usage to 1 hour a day. Use clothing lines to dry your clothes. Give up on your vacation because, after all, you know, traveling requires carbon fuels. You see, there are plenty of things that they could actually do to at least show us how committed they are. But the standard response that I get is that, you know, carbon fuel companies, big oils, are forcing carbon fuels down our throat. And that's the only reason why we, of course, depend on the product. But the case I tried to make in the paper, and I hope I'm somewhat successful. Well, I guess I'll be successful with your audience because they already know this. But, you know, market processes are essentially an unending string of trial and error processes. And when things emerge over time, it's because they are better or at least less problematic than the alternatives. And so this is why you might be familiar with that picture that ran on the internet a few months ago. A bunch of protesters against an oil rig were all in, kayaks made out of petroleum products. And I think they went out, I think it was Seattle Harbor or something. But do you realize the number of seals you would need to club to make old-fashioned kayaks instead of using petroleum products? So again, there's a reason why coal, natural gas, petroleum, synthetic products were selected through market processes historically. And if nothing else, I hope that the paper, by delving a lot more into the history than paper that are critical of the divestment movement usually do, will help well-meaning activists to perhaps get a glimpse of how markets really operate.
I want to read a passage. It's a little lengthy, but I think it's worth it from early in the paper. In fact, I think it's actually in the executive summary, but this gives a sense of a portion of your argument anyway. You say, carbon fuels made possible large-scale, reliable, and affordable long-distance transportation, which paved the way to improved overall nutrition by concentrating food production in the most suitable locations, thus making food more plentiful, diverse, and affordable. The eradication of famines by moving the surplus of regions with good harvests to those that had experienced mediocre ones. Wealth creation by facilitating the migration of large numbers of people away from the countryside and into cities. And advances in modern medicine by allowing more people to devote themselves to medical research and the development of a wide range of new and better medical products. As a direct result of greater use of carbon fuels in the last two centuries, every indicator of human well-being, from overall numbers, life expectancy, income per capita, hunger and infant mortality, to child labor and education, has improved, very often dramatically. Increased usage of carbon fuels and feedstock was also directly responsible for environmental and public health benefits, ranging from improved air and water quality and sanitation to reforestation. For instance, kerosene, propane, and heavy oil displaced poor quality biomass fuels, such as firewood and dung that filled houses with soot, particles, carbon monoxide, and toxic chemicals, and still kill millions of people today who cannot afford carbon fuels or electricity. Humanity's increased reliance on resources extracted from below the Earth's surface helped preserve and promote life forms on the surface. A case in point is the relatively recent large-scale reforestation of all advanced economies and of some developing economies, e.g. China, India, Bangladesh, and Vietnam, that can be traced back to carbon fuels-driven advances, such as drastically increased agricultural yields that made much marginal agricultural land uneconomical and available for spontaneous reforestation, and so on. So the reason you point all this out is to note that none of these points are even raised, are even acknowledged, and not even in a footnote in these campaigns.
Yeah, and I've read a number of campaign documents, and this is what is really sad in the end, in my opinion, because again, the focus is all on hypothetical risk that might kill us in the future or kill some of us in the future, but the lack of access to carbon fuels today is literally killing millions of real people each year. So again, one of the main public health problems in the world today is indoor air pollution in less advanced economies. So people who don't have access to kerosene, propane, or something better will burn literally whatever crap they found around where they live. And this is, of course, much worse than smoking, among other things. So it's estimated that between 4 and 5 million people each year, mostly mothers and young children who are around the fireplace, wherever they cook what they're eating, will actually die from that. And so, you know, there are real victims here. Poverty is a much worse killer than potentially significant climate change to which rich people could adapt. And again, denying access to reliable, affordable, and scalable energy is guaranteed to kill people. And again, somehow this just doesn't register with activists. And again, I don't question so much 20 years old who've never heard anything else in their lives, but the leaders of this movement, and unfortunately a number of professors who are also embarking on this bandwagon, should know better.
That passage from your paper that I just read, where you're talking about all these great benefits and you note that these divestment documents don't make any reference to this, it actually called to mind, there's a passage, I can't recall it exactly right now, but in the Communist Manifesto, where Karl Marx freely acknowledges the contributions made by the bourgeoisie. They have to go, of course. They have to be gotten rid of. But he absolutely acknowledges the tremendous advances in production and wealth and construction. But
the left has completely abandoned this agenda today. I mean, it used to be that old-fashioned Marxists would actually care about poor people. But somehow you look at the left today, or at least the environmental left, and you know, they've gone completely Malthusian. You know, humans are a burden. I mean, not themselves, of course, but other people. And again, the lack of understanding of energy system, the lack of understanding of the fact that, you know, again, as you alluded to, without long distance transportation, most of us would starve or would at least experience famine a few times in our lives, like was the case historically. When you depend entirely on local food, well, you will have flood, you'll have rain, you'll have too much rain, you'll have all sorts of problems. All these benefits that we take for granted simply cannot be taken for granted. But unfortunately, it's you were mentioning Alex Epstein before. He's very good at making an analogy with vaccines. You know, so some vaccines might be problematic, or at least some people might have secondary effects. But perhaps not all your listeners will agree with that. But I would argue that if you look at the broad picture, well, vaccination overall was a good thing, even though it's not perfect. Well, until something better comes along, and until people, perhaps at universities, who should actually devote their time to that, come up, rather than boycotting fossil fuel, until people come up with better ways, or at least less damageable ways to do things, reality is not optional, and divesting from fossil fuel is simply a waste of time. And what's interesting is that also a number of environmental activists on campus, but typically professors, who believe in the climate change scare scenario, will readily acknowledge that divestment will have no impact on the value of company stocks as long as there is a demand for the program on the amount of carbon fuels that are produced. And they find that deplorable because then it detracts people from other options like green taxes and cap and trade. But that's kind of another debate.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Now, what about people who say that solar energy is starting to, we're starting to see innovations there such that solar energy could conceivably become more cost and competitive and more effective?
So, well, solar and wind, and actually there is also a section of the paper in which I explain why carbon fuels and coal at the beginning displace those alternatives, because again, it might come as a shock to some, but you know, the wind was blowing, the sun was rising, there was geothermal activities before carbon fuels came along, and Europe and some portions of North America were obviously covered with windmills and little dams and what have you. Well, the big advantage of coal was that you could deliver it to places where you could build a factory in a more suitable environment, let's say a port city where water power might not be available. The problem with wind and solar was always that, you know, the wind doesn't blow much of the time. There is this thing that we call night. And so the costs are tremendous. There would be no renewable renewable energy industry at the moment without massive government subsidies, be they feeding tariffs or mandatory purchases or subsidies to get businesses started. And so there are no real alternatives. You see, transition among market economies don't require massive government support. If you look at all the infrastructure that was built for wireless communication, for example, well, you know, there was a need, there was a real technology that was better than the alternatives. The market went ahead and built it. Historically, you know, petroleum displaced coal in transportation. Well, petroleum is a liquid. It does not require you to send people underground to extract it. It's much easier to move in pipelines than coal. And so petroleum, without subsidies, displaced coal in a number of applications. And so again, if there were real opportunities, you wouldn't need those massive governments, programs, subsidies, and various means that they use to encourage alternative energy. These alternative energy would displace carbon fuels, and that would be a good thing. The fact that they don't, and that the green energy sector would not exist, would not last a day without government subsidy, should tell you something if you understand markets.
Well, that actually makes me wonder. I actually don't know what university responses to this have been. I would tend to assume not particularly favorable. There was, I'm pretty sure, some university divestment from South Africa back in the 80s, but I don't think, or I don't know exactly when it was, but yeah, it must have been the 80s. But how has this fared by comparison?
Well, so far, the universities that have divested were typically small colleges that did not own any energy stocks. Other universities, you know, have launched, well, let's call them preemptive measures. So some of universities have said, well, we'll divest from coal, but we won't divest from petroleum and natural gas. Others have said, well, we don't own any energy stocks, but we won't invest in the future. And I'm talking here like big prominent institutions like Stanford, Oxford, and a few of those. But most university administrations have actually refused to divest. And in their case, you know, if you read the statements, they will always, of course, give the obligatory note to, you know, global warming, and we need to go to do something else. But they obviously realize that a lot of these stocks are managed through commingled funds. So meaning that, you know, professional money managers who manage the accounts of many different clients are actually managing their energy stocks. And if the universities were to divest, well, there would be penalties associated with that. But on top of this, professional money managers, I suspect, don't want to be submitted to the whims of student activists, because if universities today tell them, well, okay, get rid of our energy stocks, what will be next? You know, what would be the next cause? Will it be unsustainable forestry? Will it be, you know, large pharmaceutical companies? Will it be agribusiness? And where does this end? But also, university administrators have pointed out the true facts that, you know, in the big wide ocean of financial investment money available in the world. Universities, university endowment funds are but, you know, little buckets. And within those buckets, only a few drops are actually invested in energy stocks. So overall, most universities have been reluctant to do this. A number of them came out and said flatly, no, we won't divest. But of course, new funds have been created to invest in renewable energy. New positions have been created to promote sustainable development. And so a number of universities have refused to divest, but they've put resources that will be used to, I wouldn't say placate, because I believe university administrators come from an ideological perspective in which they believe this rhetoric, but a number of resources have been made available for initiatives that I believe will prove counterproductive.
Well, with that, I'm going to urge people to read the paper for themselves. It's very, it's, you know, unlike most of these sorts of papers, it's very compellingly written. And certainly I think the, there are parts of it that have quite a punchy style for an academic paper that I very much appreciate. And your conclusions that this, even if they got what they wanted, it's not even enough to say there'd be a negligible effect on the energy companies. It'd be basically no effect.
No, there'll be no effect, but unfortunately, it's the spreading of these ideas, this demonization of carbon fuel, which I believe is
that's
the real
the
damage
effect,
that this
right.
movement is doing.
Yeah, that's the effect. And not to mention that if what they want were ever actually implemented, it would have it would take a terrible toll on not only the middle class in advanced countries, but really the poor everywhere, because it would mean, you know, much, much higher energy bills at the very least, or a lot of the normal human comforts we take for granted would simply be out of reach for the vast majority of people. There's no other way to put it.
Indeed. And it would mean also no reliable access to energy for a few billion people. And my ideal world would be one in which I could trade position with anyone in the world and be reasonably happy or not experience too much discomfort. So until that happens, I believe that more energy, more development is a good thing.
All right. And with that, Pierre, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for the conversation and for the paper.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to have Jeff Deist, who's the president of the Mises Institute. And I'll tell you, I have been binging on Mises Weekends, which is the weekend program the Institute releases, hosted by Jeff. And I just love that show. I think Jeff's a really, really underrated guy. Very, very smart and great fun to talk to. So we'll have a lot to talk about the GOP convention, the state of politics, what's a better approach than politics. Let's talk Austrian economics, some of the infighting, all kinds of fun, juicy stuff tomorrow for episode 700. Now, remember, up until you got a little time, just like the very beginning of August 2016, if you want to start that new website or blog, then I'll promote it for you. I'll give you 24 free video tutorials and this is the offer that's good only through early August. I got a 35-minute screencast video where I walk you through exactly how I've monetized my website and my online presence, and you can learn from that. So that video is a special bonus only through the next couple of weeks, maybe, if that, if even that, maybe a week and a half. So jump on that at tomwoods.com/publicity, and we'll see you tomorrow for Jeff Deist.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.